Mr. Speaker.
Order.
The second week of this four-week parliamentary adjournment saw MPs from three of Parliament's select committees return to Wellington for meetings on Monday and Tuesday, while 138 young people from across the country also convened on the Capitol for this year's Youth Parliament. We'll have more on that later in the program, but first to this week's committee business. The Social Security Legislation Rewrite Bill is a government bill updating the country's social security laws through a rewrite of the Social Security Act 1964. Speaking to the bill's first reading back in May, Social Development Minister Anne Tolley said that it was fitting that after more than 50 years, the historic piece of legislation was refreshed. In a submission to the Social Services Committee on Tuesday, Council of Trade Unions representatives voiced several of their concerns about the bill, with the CTU's General Counsel, Jeff Sissons, outlining opposition to the bill's entrenchment of drug testing requirements for beneficiaries.
Which was introduced in its current form in 2013. Now, the Ministry of Health warned at the time that this change could waste health resources and have an ambiguous overall effect on people's health and overall welfare. Now, those warnings appear to be prophetic to us. MSD notes that approximately 40% of jobs listed with work and income require a pre-employment drug test.
That led Jeff Sissons to make two observations.
First, we accept that some safety-sensitive occupations, like forestry, may justify pre-employment testing. Where being drug-free is not a genuine occupational requirement, then MSD should not permit drug testing of applicants or sanction them for failure.
And the second observation pointed to statistics around beneficiary drug testing.
One out of 200 beneficiaries test positive for drug use. So that's a failure rate of about half of 1%. Testing is an enormous cost for very little benefit. This cost is largely borne by overzealous employers, but encouraging such a waste of money is a reinforcement of wrong and lazy stereotypes. So we say that the Act's drug testing regime should be repealed.
Other concerns with the bill were outlined by Council of Trade Unions senior policy analyst Eileen Brown, who said the bill would make it harder for people to access emergency benefits.
The change now brings in sanctions and work testing and makes accessing an emergency benefit more difficult to people in already difficult circumstances. Emergency or exceptional circumstances are by their very nature unexpected and urgent. And the objective surely is that people in difficult and emergency situations can access the support they need and receive a satisfactory response to their problems as soon as possible.
Eileen Brown also noted a clause in the bill which addresses the government's stated social investment approach to welfare.
We submit against the introduction of the addition of this principle. It's not that we don't support the concept of investment in people, but the Ministry of Social Development social investment model is quite particular. It's new, it's experimental, it's dependent on a limited range of assumptions that haven't been fully evaluated, and it is not evidence-based.
And Eileen Brown also warned that UN conventions on human rights could be breached by another part of the bill,
which imposes financial sanctions if a parent on a benefit fails to identify the other parent of their child. When this is talked about, people are deeply shocked to find this in the legislation. It's highly discriminatory on women, and Māori women in particular, and it's children who bear the awful brunt of this policy. We believe it's a contravention of international human rights, and specifically that the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child is the convention on which a case could be taken. It's a matter of grave social injustice to penalise women for not disclosing the identity of their child's father.
That view was supported by Natalie Thorburn from the National Collective of Independent Women's Refuges.
Women who don't disclose their children's father's details often can't. And the situations why they can't are often really sensitive and difficult to explain. So while we're aware that there's a list of exemptions, such as for rape and incest, or for being a victim of family violence, and it's expressly stated, it's one thing to have those provisions available, and another to make sure that those women actually are able to access them. And because of the complexities and chaos around these women's situations.
Ms. Thorburn gave an example of how that could play out in practice, based on experience with women's refuge clients.
I'd like you to imagine yourself as Maria, who's a mother of three, had her first child when she was 16, and her two children have the same father, who is a pastor in her family's church. If she was to tell anyone about the situation in which her children were conceived, she would lose all social support, be shamed in her community, and be fearful of resulting violence. But Maria doesn't see what happened as rape, even though she didn't feel like she had the power to say no. She can't prove that there's any situation of violence, because she's never reported it or accessed any kind of services to help with it. She can't ask her family to back it up, because she would be so shamed if she was to disclose that even to them. So she doesn't officially meet any of the criteria for exemption and would never be willing to apply for any of those criteria.
Natalie Thorburn from the National Collective of Independent Women's Refuges with that submission to the Social Services Committee on the Social Security Legislation Rewrite Bill, which is due to be reported back to the Chamber by September the 15th. Also during this second week of a four-week adjournment, the Māori Affairs Committee met behind closed doors on Monday to make progress on business, including several treaty settlements. And the Local Government and Environment Committee also met behind closed doors on Monday for consideration of the Kermadec Ocean Sanctuary Bill. And while those three committee meetings were the only official parliamentary proceedings taking place during the week, the Chamber and several committee rooms hosted the three-yearly Youth Parliament, which has taken place regularly since 1994 when it was first held to mark the 20th anniversary of the lowering of the voting age to 18. Youth Parliament seeks to replicate the real Parliament as closely as possible. Over the course of the two-day event on Tuesday and Wednesday, youth MPs asked oral questions of ministers, participated in a general debate, sat on select committees which report recommendations to the House, and also debated the third reading of a mock bill. Meanwhile, 17 youth press gallery members also attended to report on the proceedings. Among the 121 youth MPs was 18-year-old Timothy Rowe, who was sponsored by National's Whanganui MP, the Deputy Speaker, Chester Burrows. Tom Fruin asked Timothy Rowe how he got to be a youth MP.
First of all, just tell me a little bit about yourself. Where did you go to school?
I went to Whanganui High School. I was a head prefect at Whanganui High School, and I'm from Whanganui originally. Grew up there, and then now I've moved to Wellington to study law and commerce.
At Victoria?
Yes, at Victoria.
Okay, and how did you become a youth MP?
Oh, well, I actually saw an advert in the paper, and it was for Chester Burrows. He asked youth to write submissions to be chosen for youth MP, and explained the outlines, the you know, what it would entail. And I believe there were lots of submissions, but you write a submission to Chester, and Chester will call you up and have a conversation with you. And we answered a few questions. We talked about, at the time, I think Chris Brown was a big issue, about letting him into the country. So we had a talk about that, about a 15-minute conversation. And then he called all of the applicants that he thought could do it. And then at the end, he called me back and said, look, I think you've got the job, but I want to catch up and have lunch or something like that. And so we caught up, had some food, and had another chat about politics, and he picked me for Youth MP.
Right. So this is the second day, is it, of the...
second day of Youth Parliament, yeah.
What have you thought of it so far?
Well, I love arguing, for a start. No, the House on the first day, the question time, was... It got a bit heated, and it was quite fun. It's quite interesting, because we had actual ministers answering questions from... you know, 120-odd youth. And these are 120-odd youth who love picking people apart, you know, and, you know, breaking down arguments and things like that. And there was a lot of jokes made at the social gathering afterwards that we actually stumped a few of them, you know, with questions that actually could be applied and actually...
A supplementary question, Nathan Wilson.
Does the Minister agree that this regional cycle policy is just a way to help the Greens get from town to town in the 2017 election?
The order, questions in order. The questions in order, the Honourable Nikki Kaye, and a short answer, please.
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Transport, there are lots of political parties love cycling. In fact, I think I can name a good 30 National MPs who get on their bike.
That's right.
These four ministers, they were cabinet ministers, all kind of, I think they went away from it, having learned a little bit about what youth can do.
You've got your questions answered or just addressed?
Oh, well, I'm predominantly in the general debate, which is today, and I'm doing a speech to the House.
I call Timothy Rowe.
The Youth MP for the Honourable Chester Burrows.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I don't want to die. Most of us cannot fully understand the mentality of someone wanting to die. It's for those who can, for those who live in a miserable pain, both physically and emotionally, those who depend on others to complete the simplest human functions. It's because of these people that we must discuss euthanasia.
We did select committee yesterday as well, and learning about the select committee process was really interesting. The fact that the public can just come in and just talk to you, and that you have to analyse and break down their arguments to see if they're actually valid. And I think that, you know, that's a skill that's going to benefit all of us, even if we don't go into politics. So, yeah.
Will you go into politics?
I like politics, and I remember getting the job, and my parents were... I said, oh, yeah, I might go into politics now, and my parents went, awesome. You know, then I've never really considered politics as a viable kind of job because of the chances of getting in. You've got no job security, you know, you're relying on people to vote for you to keep your job. And that's always been a bit kind of weird. It's a weird concept for me. I'm doing law and commerce, and I think that when I finish my degree, I have a better understanding of what I want to do, but I still have no idea. So, you know.
If you went into politics, would you want to go in as an MP? And if you did, would you want to be an electorate MP or a list MP?
I would love to be an MP. Whether I'm a list or electorate, I think if I wanted to get into Parliament, I would probably try as an electorate MP. I'm not affiliated with the party at the moment, and I don't think that's going to change until I get out of university, so I'll have to see how it pans out. I mean, if I wanted to get into Parliament, I'd love to be an MP. I'm not sure what MP.
Right. With an electorate MP, you're representing an electorate, yeah, representing people. With a list MP, you might be able to specialise more in issues.
Mm.
Which do you think that you'd prefer to do? Would you like to represent people or change things?
Well, if I was representing, and I know Chester's the MP for Whanganui, but if I represented Whanganui, I'd be very happy to. I mean, it's an amazing town with amazing people, and I'd love to have that responsibility. And not that I would now, because I'm in university and things like that, but if I ended up being the MP for Whanganui, I'd be very happy. If I was the MP for Wellington, where I'm living now, I'd be very happy. But I don't like the idea of going, you know, somewhere in the country that you've never been before, knowing nothing about it, you know. So if the opportunity came up, I would go for I'd go be an electorate MP. But if it didn't, then a list MP is obviously the other choice. And I think that it would definitely provide more chance or more, you'd be able to spend more time on issues that meant more to you personally. Yeah.
There are other ways of getting into politics. I believe that you work in the press gallery.
The press gallery is furiously writing things about us, and we have to get interviewed by them, and it's kind of not a mock press, but they still do all this press on it. But it's an opportunity for them and an opportunity for us, and I haven't written anything personally for them just yet, but they'll get a copy of my speech and they'll get a copy of what I've done today.
The great American novelist David Foster Wallace once said, "A person in agony will consider killing themselves as an option in the same way in which a trapped person will consider jumping from the window of a burning skyscraper." People around us face a fate worse than that of death, yet the government refuses their right to die. Why? Isn't it moral to give someone a choice to jump rather than force them into the flames? Thank you.
Youth MP Timothy Rowe speaking in this year's Youth Parliament General Debate. Finally, on Monday, the government presented its response to the report of the Justice and Electoral Committee on its inquiry into the last general election on September the 20th, 2014. The committee's inquiry contained several recommendations aimed at updating aspects of the Broadcasting Act regarding election campaign advertising. The committee recommended that the government clarify the difference between an election program and election advertising. Ambiguity in this area led to the ban on the Planet Key satirical video and a lengthy High Court judgment. The committee also reported that TVNZ no longer sees itself as a national public broadcaster and should not be obliged to provide free time for political party broadcasts. Rather than address these recommendations directly, the government is bundling them off to the Ministry of Culture and Heritage for inclusion in an overhaul of the 1989 Broadcasting Act, to be replaced by new legislation called the Digital Convergence Bill. For more on that, stay tuned, as they say. I'm Rhys Lyon, reporting for ParliamentToday.co.nz with funding from Parliament.